You're listening to Girovagando by the Cycling Podcast. Today we are at the Santuario di Europa.
Cozze citele, cozze, cozze piscine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze citele, cozze, cozze piscine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
What's your name? My name is Francesco. Francesco, we're a famous, well, location. There are so many monuments to Pantani in Italy. This one is the Bandana di Pantani. You've got an original Marco Pantani bandana on today. What do you remember of that day in 1999?
I remember the image that Marco Pantani is near this zone, break the chain and stop. But then ride to bicycle. He reached to win this stage with the help of his...
Buonasera, Brian il Barone.
Buonasera, Daniel.
The
talented Mr. Freebie.
Brian, what we heard there, what we heard from one of the many, one of the legions of Marco Pantani fans on the mountain today, on the mountain, on the climb towards the Santuario di Europa. It was the Montagna Pantani. It was a Pantani tribute. It was a Pantani love fest, wasn't it? There was a Curva Pantani at 2.5 or 2.6 kilometers to go. We saw Francesco, the gentleman there. He was from near Milan, Ro, and we saw him at the Bandana di Pantani, which is a monument unveiled in 2018. It's like a Medusa, isn't it? 21 sort of these kind of shards.
Rusty Medusa.
Very rusty. But quite fetching. We've been there. I've been there before because we stayed very close to that monument a couple of years ago, and I ran past and I did a little video, I remember. Those 21, well, the components of it, they sort of all represent someone who contributed money to the monument. But yeah, one of the more interesting Pantani monuments. We'll talk later about the merits, really, and whether the Giro d'Italia ought to be paying tribute in this way to Marco Pantani. I suppose the finger of blame, if there is a finger to be pointed tonight, it's not necessarily at the Giro d'Italia and RCS. I mean, they're at liberty to use any mountain in Italy, and you know, there has been a certain amount of Pantani tributing today, but it's more some of the other stuff we've seen and heard. But we'll talk about that later. Brian, can you describe this extraordinary scene all around us?
I've never been here before. The Santuario up here in Europa is one of the most magnificent buildings I've seen on any mountains in my life, I think.
You don't like mountains?
No, but it just makes sense for it to sort of... I mean, it is a sanctuary, but it sort of... You have the huge the church behind us. You have this, which by and large looks like a huge monastery. I don't know what the historical significance of this building was. I think there's an attached story that you might know better than me, but it's really beautiful. It's very calm, and sitting here now, you know, shortly after noisy ending of a Giro stage, there's quite this sort of the somber, reflective atmosphere of this place. I really like it here.
Yes, Brian, it's sprawling, isn't it? It's a huge structure. Yeah, we've got, we're drinking a Menebrea. We talked about Menebrea last night in the podcast. Menebrea brewed in Biella.
So the foot of the climb, really.
The foot of the climb. Did I mention yesterday they've got a nice, like, pizzeria? I think it's a pizzeria or a trattoria, a Menebrea, where you can go there, and I think there's a museum attached as well. Yeah, lots of different components to the Santuario. The gate, just to, well, your left, my right, that was the architect for that was Juvara, who is the architect behind Superga, which we talked a lot about in Torino. A couple of things to mention about the Santuario di Europa. It's one of these Sacri Monti, these sacred mountains of Piedmont and Lombardy, a series of nine calvaries, groups of chapels that were built during the late 16th and 17th century, dedicated to various aspects of the Christian faith. The legend, the big legend here is about, it's a black wooden, well, a Madonna Nera, black Madonna, who supposedly would gain weight when anyone tried to remove her from the Santuario, and she made it impossible for anyone to do that. So she is still in situ somewhere in this wonderful collection of buildings.
Sounds a bit like our clutch today, Daniel.
Oh, clutch, what a nightmare that was. Yeah, the Darwin Atapuma. We've named the car Atapuma. It isn't, well, not a very imaginative nickname. We've got a Ford Puma.
I think that's Bananita would be a bit more...
Darwin Atapuma, a very competent, very accomplished climber in his time, of course. Our Darwin Atapuma proved not to be a very accomplished climber on the road up to the Santuario de Europa. And in fact, substitutions are not allowed in Grand Tours as far as teams and riders are concerned. But there might be a substitution of Darwin Atapuma tomorrow.
The puma needs to be put back in its cage.
Yes, I think so. But Brian, we saw today, I suppose, more or less what we expected to see. Those who haven't already watched the stage have probably guessed based on what I have just said. But we are going to recap. We're going to fill them in on what did happen today. And it's time for today's Processo alla Tappa.
Il Processo alla Tappa. The post-stage inquisition.
Brian, let's have another go at this, shall we, after yesterday's roaring world premiere. Brian, today's stage, where did it start from and where did it finish and how long was today's stage?
Daniel, stage two of this year's Giro d'Italia started in San Francesco di Campo and finished up here at the Santuario di Europa, and the length was 161 kilometers.
Was there a breakaway, Brian?
Yes, Daniel, there was a breakaway that was created after around 10 kilometers of racing. Five riders, Christian Scaroni of Astana, Andrea Piccolo of EF Education, Davide Baez of Polti, and the two Bardiani riders, Filippo Fiorelli and Martin Marcellusi.
Do you know, Brian, I'm really testing you now. Do you know what their maximum, or what was roughly their maximum advantage?
Oh, you caught me there, Daniel, but my guess would be around 4 minutes.
I think it was in the fours, wasn't it? And where were they caught, Brian? Where were the last remnants of the break caught?
The very last remnants of the break was Andrea Piccolo, and he was caught with 6.5 kilometers to go, Daniel.
Thereafter, what happened, Brian? Talk us into the finish from there.
I'll have to hit the fast-forward button because a lot actually happened before the climb, and what happened was that Tadej Pogacar crashed. He had a puncture on his front tire, and he crashed actually trying to, like, curve his way around back into the ideal line of the road, but he crashed, and then he basically, and this is all the Pantani I'm gonna tell you, but he had to chase back up through both the remnants of the peloton and the riders getting dropped, and then he eventually made himself up to the front, and then UAE hit the gas initially a little bit like yesterday with Mikkel Bjerg, the Dane, being the first one, and Rafael Majka being the last one. He launched Pogacar at 4.4 kilometers to go, and he accelerated pretty hard. Initially, Ben O'Connor was actually on his wheel. He then, I think he flew a little bit too close to the sun and got his wings burned and grouped up with Geraint Thomas. And then Kian Etebroeks was actually doing pretty well in trying to follow. But Pogacar was gone, not significantly, but gone enough to win the stage and take the jersey.
Brian, there were lots of riders sort of yo-yoing behind Pogacar. There were lots of riders who looked good at one point, and then the next time the camera showed them, they were struggling. We'll try and make sense of some of that later, but just, if you will, give us a rundown on... Let's have a top 10 today, because there are a lot of riders still in contention.
Yeah, so Tadej Pogacar won the race, obviously the stage, after 3 hours and 54 minutes of racing. A group after him consisted of Dani Martinez, Geraint Thomas, Lorenzo Fortunato, Florian Lipovic, also of Bora Hansgrohe.
Is it my fantasy team?
Yeah, basically your entire fantasy team was coming in after him. And they were 22nd seconds behind. Then another small group with Michael Storer, Cian Uytterbroeks, Aina Rubio and Juanpi López of Little Trek. That's 35 seconds. And then the biggest sort of, before you really see a gap, it's still, you know, you still have riders less than 2 minutes in the top 20. So the top 10 is, so I mentioned Juanpi López, and then in 10th was Jan Heert of Quickstep, and he was 30 seconds. And I almost like naturally my inclined to say only 37 seconds behind, because I think that was also a little bit the feeling that, yeah, Pogacar won, but he didn't, yeah, he dropped the hammer, but he didn't create an earthquake in the process.
Brian, there were some victims of the sort of muted Pogceneration today, first and foremost, the gentleman who started the day in the Maglia Rosa, Jonathan Narváez. Where did he come in and how much time did he lose?
Jonathan Narváez lost a jersey and he came in 2 minutes and 3 seconds after Tadej Pogačar.
Any other big losers, Brian? I'm looking down the general classification. We talked, obviously, yesterday about Romain Bardet, who rallied pretty well and limited his losses yesterday. Bardet was 20th, and he finished 1 minute and 20 down. Now, that's not, well, certainly not ideal. He would have liked to finish close to Pogacar, but I know that DSM Firmenich post NL, to give him their full name, they were slightly worried about him finishing in a bit of a no man's land today, and he has done precisely that because he's not going to be allowed to get in a breakaway immediately. He's going to need to lose more time, yet he has lost significant ground in the general classification. Tymon Arensman, he didn't rally well yesterday. He was dropped and continued to lose time and lost over 2 minutes yesterday, and he lost another 1 minute and 36 today, which is pretty costly. Maybe more about Arensman a little bit later.
I think we need to mention Antonio Tiberi as well. He suffered the same fate, but with a lot worse of an outcome as Tadej Pogačar, because he punctured. And he punctured in a really crucial time because he spent all his energy trying to claw his way back, and he lost 2 minutes and 24 seconds.
Brian, he punctured with 6 kilometers to go, I believe, and then he was given a replacement bike and he felt, he told us at the finish, he told a group of journalists that he felt that the tire was deflated on the second bike as well. And that cost him time. So a really bad start as far as he's concerned. There were various other sort of riders who lost more ground today. Luke Plapp lost a little bit more time as well, 18th, 1 minute and 20 down. But we will try to digest and analyse all of that in just a moment. We should give the general classification because it has, well, after 2 days, it's been shaken up quite significantly. Brian, give us maybe the top five, and you can select some other big hitters as well.
Yeah, with
maybe
pleasure, Daniel. So
further down.
Pogacar has the pink jersey tonight, and second place in the general classification is Geraint Thomas, and he's 45 seconds after him. Danny Martinez in the same 45 seconds after. Sianito Brooks, 54 seconds. Same for Aina Rubio. Lorenzo Fortunato, relatively surprised. He did climb very well today. And now riding for Astana, he was 1 minute and five behind. Ben O'Connor, we spoke about him maybe, you know, burning one too many matches trying to follow Pogacar. He is now in 10th spot, but only, and I kind of mean that because the Giro is still very long, and he's 125 behind.
Traditionally, this is a tradition that dates back to yesterday. At the end of the Processo alla Tappa, you asked me a question as well.
It'll be the same as yesterday. That's how inventive I am. Did you, Daniel, as talented as you are, speak to anyone interesting after the stage?
I spoke to a couple of riders. I spoke to one of Tadej Pogacar's domestiques today and every day, UAE Team Emirates, Michael Bier. And also Geraint Thomas, who had another good day and his second on general classification. As you said, Brian, 45 seconds down. So here they are, Bier and Thomas.
No, we wanted to go for the stage if we had the help from Ineos to control the race from the start. And yeah, they were really keen to pull also in the final. Actually, they were pulling really strong with Ganna. So yeah, in the end, they helped us a lot. And yeah, in the last climb, I think Tadej had a puncture in the bottom, but I didn't hear anything in the radio. So I was just like, oh, okay, everything is fine. And then suddenly they're like, ah! Yeah, like, yeah, they did a big effort to bring him back with Domen and Felix. So, yeah, I think the team worked really well together today.
Not only a puncture, but also crashed. Did you know that?
I didn't know. As long as he's okay, that's important for me.
Yeah, he is okay. What does it mean for you, Mikkel, to help today winning the first stage in the Giro?
No, it's really nice. I think, you know, when everything comes together, then it's really nice. We see Rui and Vegard also pull super strong today, so... Yeah, I think today it really worked, and yeah, yesterday we missed like 1%, so yeah.
And Mikko, how are you experiencing this situation of being, well, such strong favourites for this race? Does it feel different even to the tours you've done, that all of the pressure, all of the attention is on you guys?
You know, it doesn't change too much. You don't have, you know, Jonas or Jumbo like as strong as they are in the tour, but yeah, you know, everybody here is super strong. I think now is... Ineos, they were really strong today, and they helped us also a bit, so that was really nice. But hopefully tomorrow we get some help from the sprint teams.
What about these next few days? Do you expect, well, a couple of sprint days, and then do you expect much more to happen on GC before we get to sort of Prati di Tivo?
Yeah, you know, never say never. Maybe they try to attack Tadej, and I think stage six will be really important. And then, yeah, then obviously the TT, and then, yeah, we go on rest day.
You did finish third place, getting some bonus seconds, but your reaction there to the Tadej show?
Oh, nothing new, that is it, but we expected it. I was hoping to follow, but I knew if I tried to keep going like that, I'd completely blow her. Felt bad for sitting on Ben, but I was on the limit for a while there. I had to recover, and the group came up to us, and then it was a case of just trying to recover and try and get some points in there, some seconds in the sprint again.
And you did show your wisdom, because later O'Connor lost time. You were able to just keep pulling on up to the finish.
Yeah, I don't know really what happened to him, but like I say, I did feel quite bad not pulling, but I was like, mate, I'm on the limit now, and I just had to judge it, and wait for that group to come and get us and try and just recover.
Ineos going strong all day. Did you know about the puncture and crash of Tadej at the base of the climb?
No, honestly, I didn't know until we got to the climb, and then they said, Tadej's back. I was like, oh, right, okay. The radios are just terrible, but so no real idea, but yeah, the plan was to go on the front with, I don't know, like the, not the penultimate one, but the one before that anyway. Because it was technical, take it up there, ride the front. Not attack him, but just be safe at the front, fast tempo, and we knew it'd be chaos behind.
The cycling podcast at the 2024 Giro d'Italia is supported by MAP, cycling apparel.
A big thank you to MAP, the cycling podcast clothing partner, of course. And you may remember a couple of years ago, MAP designed and created the fantastic cycling podcast jersey. MAP are now the suppliers for a pro team. They have teamed up with Life Plus Wahoo, the women's pro team, to design and make the kit for Life Plus Wahoo. And you can check it out at map.cc if you've not seen it already. And if you're in the UK, you can see the Life Plus Wahoo team racing on British roads at the end of this month. They're in the peloton for the Ford Ride London Classique, which is a 3-day stage race. It starts in Saffron Walden. I was actually over that way a few weeks ago myself, riding on the roads. It starts on Friday, May the 24th, finishes a couple of days later with a stage in London. And Life Plus Wahoo will be racing in their MAP kit on British roads at the end of the month. If you want to go to map.cc, you can check out the Life Plus Wahoo jersey, and well, you can buy it for yourself if you like it. It looks fantastic, and if you buy a couple of items from the Life Plus Wahoo range, there are some nice discounts to be had as well. So map.cc is the website that you need. And if you're interested in the Life Plus Wahoo team, look out for a series of short films coming later this month. They've gone behind the scenes with Life Plus Wahoo, and the series Made This will be coming out later in May. Probably the best way to keep in touch with what's going on at MAP is to follow MAP on Instagram.
Well, Brian, we got the outcome that we sort of expected yesterday. Tadej Pogacar already in the Maglia Rosa. I spent the last sort of half an hour, last 40 minutes of the stage. I was standing next to Andrea Agostini, who I think is the CEO of UAE Team Emirates, also a really good childhood friend of Marco Pantani, and also Mauro Gianetti. And there was some mirth, there was some laughter among those of us who were close to Andrea Agostini, because we sort of suggested that when Pogacar had his problem in Biella and he had his crash, we suggested that this might have been staged by UAE in a sort of reprise or in a tribute to the Pantani stage in 1999. One sort of serious thing that did cross my mind, serious point that I would make about that, Brian, is that we often see, we saw this very famously with the controversial Lance Armstrong at Ardiden in 2003, when riders have those issues at the bottom of climbs and they have to chase back a little bit, often they get a shot of adrenaline and they often overperform.
But now, we don't even have to go that far back. You remember Roglic on Montelusari last year?
Yes.
You know, dropping his chain,
yes,
and going significantly faster, yeah, after that than before.
Indeed. And that brings me to my first question in this segment, Brian. 20, what was the final margin? 27 seconds. even par, under par, over par for Tadej Pogacar?
I think the question, and I don't mean to be rude, it needs to be qualified, because if is that a one-to-one reflection of his maximum output today? I think not. I think
a few people said that, but yeah. I also heard a few people say that he looked knackered at the finish line.
Yeah, I think I was the one, or one of the people telling you, he certainly did. I just think, you know, coming back to both in the preview and in the kilometer zero, where Jeroen Swart talks about his numbers, his how much better he is this year, a lot of that has to do with endurance, etc. But the watts that he's pushing is, I mean, we also saw that he was above 8 watts per kilo on the last climb yesterday, where he was trying to make the difference. I think the best Pogacar would be able to, I have no reason to believe that he's not at his best here, why wouldn't he be, would normally be able to take a minute, maybe not more. I mean, I think that the legend of Europa outlives its real difficulty. So in that sense, and I also think for Pogacar's own understanding of how he needs to build the architecture of trying to win this Giro, he doesn't necessarily have to go even deeper to gain that extra half a minute. There's plenty of other places during the next couple of weeks where he can do that. So I would say it's he chose, I believe, we'll see if I'm right, maybe we'll never know. I think he chose to put the marker down where he did. And he might also want to keep the competition a little bit closer at this point of the race. If not, they might gang up on him at some point. So I think there was a prudent decision behind him not going any deeper than he did.
I don't think he disgusted and exasperated the opposition as we thought that he might today.
No. But he still leads the race with 45 seconds, and you know, he's still the outright favorite to bring the jersey home. So they have every reason to be happy.
Yes, Brian, yesterday their team came in for quite a lot of scrutiny. There were suggestions, which I sort of disagreed with in the podcast. There were suggestions that they hadn't performed that well. Just before you answer that question, I've just brought up the results from 2017. Just to your point about it not being... it's not a monster sort of Dolomite climb or Alpine climb. I just looking at the time gaps for Tom Dumoulin was the winner in 2017. The time gaps were small that day. 3 seconds to Zakarin, 9 seconds to Landa, 14 seconds to Nairo Mann, the lesser sighted Nairo Mann, who is in this Giro d'Italia, but you won't see him very close to the front of the race. So it is not the most selective climb, is it?
I would like to make 2 points about that.
Two? You've only got one credit.
They also have to, first of all, they know that this year is very long, and I think sacrificing every... I mean, Mikel Bjerg is not necessarily a climber, but he's really good on
good for a day like today.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't want him to do that every single day up to, like, beyond, you know, potentially having a horrible last week. There are some pretty hard stages in the last week. So I think they're administrating that wisely, because it doesn't really matter, I think, to them whether he leads with 45 seconds or if he was leading with a minute and a half now. So I think trying to ask the team to go any harder, I think it's a bit futile for the for the overall project. And second of all, they're not just thinking about the next 2 weeks, the next 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks. They're also thinking about what they're going to do, how Pogacar will recover after the Giro, and how his energy expenditure will be leading up to the Tour. So I think all of those come into play. I mean, they will, and they will do everything they can to win the Giro, but not necessarily every single day going as hard as they possibly can. That wouldn't be smart, would it?
I think if there has been one sort of criticism or doubt or misgiving about the UAE team at this Giro d'Italia, it's that they're light on climbing power. Of course, Jay Vine was supposed to be at this Giro. Interestingly, they replaced Vine not with another climber but with a ruler. Vegard Lengen was the rider who came in for Jay Vine, but I thought they were pretty good today.
They were fast when he was in trouble. You know, they came back. They picked him up.
Yeah.
They never stressed, and you could also almost see the picking Lengen. I mean, they had to because Jay Vine was unable to start. It's also, he's more of a bodyguard type of rider. He's a ruler. He can protect him on the flat. You know, and there certainly are a lot of those stages where he'll come in handy. And leaving Jay Vine at home because he's, you know, obviously injured, I think it's a testimony to the fact that Pogacar can finish the business when he needs to. I don't, I, I if he needs the team to put tempo on the latter part of the climbing stages, but they don't need him to squeeze the competition. I think Pogacar can do that all by himself.
Yeah, he's quite happy to sort of don his Superman cape at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 kilometers from the finish. He might even do it later in the race. We might see him do it on penultimate climbs rather than on the last climb of stages. Brian, our good friends, our colleagues at Alvento, I might have already alluded to this in our preview or maybe yesterday, they have set one of their members a challenge, Marta Bacigalupo, who is going to appear. I'm going to get her on our podcast in a few days. I think they're calling it the Pogacario. Her task in this Giro d'Italia is to uncover facts about Pogacar that no one knows or no one knew. And I'm going to go head-to-head with Marta. I'm going to try to do the same thing. I already tried this with Tadej Pogacar in the past. In his breakthrough Vuelta a España 2019, I was bugging his press officer, Luke McGuire, every day for color about Tadej Pogacar.
Well, I have one that I'm not sure that you know.
Go on.
Were you aware that he is a cat owner?
It's funny you should say that because he's not a cat owner.
What?
Because Marta's first installment of the Pogacario, I think they're calling it.
That's a myth-busting that I'm not very pleased with.
Yeah. It's the neighbor's cat, Brian.
Oh.
It's the neighbor's cat.
It looked like to be of a Siberian breed.
It did look like, you know this well because you've got a Siberian cat. But no, it's not. Apparently, well, it would be incompatible with the lifestyle of Uska and Tadej Pogacar because they're both professional cyclists, both away at races a lot.
I mean, Karl Lagerfeld had a full-time person in his payroll to take care of his cat Choupette, who's actually one of his only heirs.
They could probably... There's a documentary about that, isn't there?
Yeah. There should be.
They could probably afford a cat sitter. The one bit of colour that I was able to uncover in the 2019 Vuelta after days of trying was that at that point, in the race, Tadej Pogacar's nighttime reading material was The Godfather by Mario Puzo. So one of his entourage today, I won't say who it was, joked to me, yeah, that's still the book he's reading.
Oh, really?
In 2024.
I mean, maybe a lot of people don't know that. You know, he did actually prequels. I know that the parts of the 1, 2, 3 of Coppola's movies are, you know, there's prequels and etc. But you know, he did actually produce more books than just those three. And I know that because I read one of them, and it's pretty mediocre to say the least.
We touched on riders who struggled yesterday, and we mentioned that Romain Bardet is now in a bit of a difficult position. I mean, he came in as one of the sort of the favourites to win the race of the sort of terrestrials. And he's in a difficult position now because he lost more time today, but maybe not enough time. There were other riders who struggled yesterday and struggled again today. Incidentally, on Bardet, he vomited on yesterday's stage. This wasn't caught on camera. We said yesterday he had had stomach problems on the Maddalena, but he actually, I don't know whether he stopped to vomit, but he did vomit. And after that, he felt a lot better, apparently. Lipovitz is an interesting one. He was today sort of Icarus because he struggled yesterday, had a brilliant Tour de Romandie, struggled yesterday and was one of the best of the rest today. I briefly chatted to Bernie Eisel, one of his direct supporters at Bora Hansgrohe, after the finish, and I asked Bernie about Lipovitz's performance yesterday, and he said that after the Tour of Romandie, hadn't really done any hard efforts and he needed a day to sort of open him up again. And that day was yesterday, but unfortunately it cost him.
That's always the difficult thing for a lot of riders when the Giro starts short and hard, as it did yesterday. And then today was yesterday was a punchier stage. Today was a more or less real climber stage. It was certainly a mountaintop finish.
But Brian, I wanted to speak about another rider who struggled yesterday, and that was Timon Arensman.
This is still within the realm of a Processo da Tappa because it has an air, maybe a digital air, of Polemica.
Yeah, it does definitely have an air of Polemica. Last night, Brian, Arensman was thrust into the spotlight by none other than his father, Martijn, who tweeted... let's see if I can bring up the tweet, because I screenshotted it in the anticipation that it would be taken down in short order. I don't think it was taken down, actually. I think it stayed up there. Here it is. The nicest thing about starting a Grand Tour is that no trainer can crew up, I think he meant screw up, a cyclist's form anymore for the next 3 weeks. Hopefully it won't be too screwed up for now, pretty damning. Salty. Yeah, salty. Shots fired. Interesting as well, Brian, because people might wonder, who is Tymon Arensman's coach? Well, I can tell you that Tymon Arensman has been coached by Dajos, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, D-A-J-O, Sanders, for several years, and was coached by him at his previous team, DSM, and in fact, brought Sanders with him to Ineos Grenadiers. This is also not the first time that Martijn Arensman has tweeted fairly, well, outspoken sort of views, criticisms of team management. He did it once at DSM. Tymon Arensman didn't have a big profile at that time, so it sort of went under the radar. But certainly not ideal for the team at all. I think they were pretty miffed, shall we say, this morning.
Rightfully so, yeah, in my opinion.
I was just going to ask you, Brian, in your former capacity as a team press officer, because we're going to hear in a minute someone from the Ineos organisation respond to this, but how would you have responded to it back in the day?
I was lucky enough to also be a major parts of the 15, 16 years I worked that job. There wasn't social media, and what a blessing that was. I would say you need to nip that one in the bud, really, and maybe make it like a little bit more banal or diminish the relevance of it. But
wow.
By telling Arensman himself, like Junior, to say, well, you know, my dad's an emotional person. He's you know, strongly invested in my career. It's really like, you know.
What, Arensman should be tweeting this, do you think?
No, I don't think so, because I think that would be giving it too much attention. But when met the morning after by gentlemen such as yourself or the journalist, that he should relativize it and say, yeah, you know, my dad is, you know. And everyone understands that. We've all seen fathers, even mothers, you know, on football fields and Little League baseball, you know, shouting at the coach, shouting at the referee. So that's, people understand that. But I think it becomes a bigger problem when Arensman himself does not actually take that route.
Yeah, and I'm not sure whether he did speak to the media today. I know he didn't speak to the media after yesterday's stage. By all accounts, he's quite an intense individual, Tymon Arensman, which can be a good thing. The way someone who knows him well described it to me today is that he can get inside his head a lot. I don't know whether he got on the front foot this morning or indeed after the stage and pronounced on what his father had tweeted. Maybe he did, so we should reserve judgment.
I mean,
on that.
One thing that I think also needs to be mentioned, and that's not an external, it's not a PR thing, it's also his position internally on the team and how the other riders feel like they potentially will have to answer questions about his role in the team, about that tweet his dad did. And I think all of that is a nuisance for riders, especially more senior riders will probably also think like, why are we actually dealing with this? Why don't you just get in line and support the team? We don't really need your dad to have an opinion. Maybe they'll take care of it that way. I mean, he's certainly a young rider on that team, and he's a young rider in terms of GC experience. So someone should probably, you know, go and have a bit of a friendly chat to him, but also trying to understand the chain reaction of things. Had this been in the tour, mind you, it would have been 10 times as big.
Yeah.
It would have been like, if this is just polemica, and there'll be like a, you know, you and I talk about it.
Do you know what? He's quite fortunate, Brian, that I don't know if you've noticed, I was in the press room briefly yesterday, and it varies year to year how many, for example, Dutch journalists are at a Giro d'Italia. If there was another Dutch rider here who was contending for general classification, it would mean that all of the major players in Dutch media would have sent someone, and there would be maybe six or seven big journalists here, crews. I don't think that's the case this time, because they're precisely the people who would have seized on this and built it up into something even greater than it's become over the last 24 hours.
Well, I think also, like, and this is the last thing I'm going to say about this, unless you ask me another question, it is also he doesn't need to have that air of whinging around him, you know. I mean, ultimately, because as you mentioned yourself, he brought this coach with him, so that must have been his own choice, and the team accepted it, and not the other way around. And seeing that he underperformed, I mean, ultimately you can blame all kinds of people for where you are before a big goal and how well you fare during it, but the problem is really his, in my opinion. It's not the coach, the problem is his. He chose him, he accepted the training, and he told the team that he was ready to, you know, to be one of the eight riders here, and he underperformed. So
tough words, brutal. they don't call him the attack dog, the Great Dane, for nothing. Now, Great Danes aren't very vicious. You're more vicious than a Great Dane. Brian, Ineos, in spite of, notwithstanding what we've just said, they've had a good start to the Giro d'Italia. They've had a good month indeed. The train is sort of back on the rails, if it was ever off them. We spoke a few weeks ago at Paris-Nice. We did a special Kilometre Zero. It was called The Diary of a CEO. I met their new CEO, John Allott, the other sort of the kind of second prong of their new leadership duo is Scott Draw. He is the performance director of Ineos Grenadiers. I spoke to him this morning about how things were going and also about Arensman. This is an extract from that interview. It was a little bit longer than this. I think it was about 12 minutes, the whole interview. And I'm going to post that at some point in the next couple of days on Substack. And 1101 Cappuccino or Lionel will post it for us. In the meantime, Brian, Scott Draw is the subject of today's
La Chiacchierata del Giorno, the chin wag of the day.
Well, Scott, we met for the first time a few weeks ago at Paris-Nice. Would it be correct to say that things are going better now, today, with Jonathan Narváez in the pink jersey today, than they were in March, at the beginning of March?
Yeah, I mean, it's great for the team to see Johnny's success yesterday. I think what you often don't realise is the amount of planning and thought that goes into the preparation for a Grand Tour. And the conversations around the opportunities here started way back in October, November time through December camp. I guess when you plan like the guys have done to see that to come success really lifts the team, everybody, not those that are just here, other riders, other support staff that are in the background. So yeah, it's great to see. I mean, but it's not been the only signs. I think, you know, we've sort of seen some of the performances from the guys, Tom, obviously at Amstel Gold, Carlos, Egan's progress. There's lots of positive signs around the quality of staff, the quality of riders that we have, and I think it's only going to go in one direction from our perspective. The team are working super hard, and I think we want to get back to where we were at.
Scott, when I did speak to you briefly at Paris-Nice, you described, I think we talked, as I say, briefly about what your role was going to be, what you saw as being your role, and you talked about a bit of a watching brief at first, or a bit of a sort of fact-finding period where you wanted to observe and see what maybe needed to be changed. Can you tell us about things that you did identify very quickly and you're already in the process of changing?
Like you say, I'm week 8 really of my initial, so probably in some ways just getting towards the end of my honeymoon period. We have got some highly motivated, dedicated staff and riders that want to succeed. I think generally we've articulated this, the team's narrowing down its focus towards the Grand Tours. We've got a huge amount of positive stuff going on, but at sometimes having brilliant knowledge and the application of that knowledge in this context is sometimes where the gap is. So that difference between knowledge and delivery, and certainly in an area, you know, that I'm really familiar with when I was previous in the team, certainly around our performance support, you know, we absolutely want to up our ante in that space, particularly in the science tech innovation area. But we've got some highly motivated people and we just need to be smart about how we go about where we choose to spend time and effort, particularly in that space. I think obviously as well, when we, you know, want to be a Grand Tour team, you don't put all your eggs in that basket. You've got to be really successful in the one-day races. So really looking at how we train, how we prepare for those, how that leads on to the Grand Tour. So, you know, we're having a reset and review around everything. I think everyone is being honest enough around looking back about what are the things that we did in the past that we don't want to forget. And where is the latest knowledge and practice, particularly around endurance, in endurance sport like this? What are we missing? What do we need to do differently? So there's a lot of internal review and reflection, and that's the process that we're going through. Everyone's motivated to do that because they want to be better. And as I sort of said at the start, every coach, every staff member are looking at what we do so we can improve every element of what we do. And I think that's what's going to put us in a better place. So there's not one thing, but I think our ability to look hard at ourselves is always a critical part of being better going forward. And I think, and that's the thing that we're trying to do now. Look hard at ourselves, look back at the good things that we've done in the past. You never throw the baby out of the bathwater in some senses, but also look at where the future is. It's not just about now, it's about what's the sport going to look like in 2030. Try to predict that and work towards it, because if we keep trying to chase what next year's going to look like, we're still going to be behind the curve. And so it's really important we now look forward. We've got brilliant connections in academia, in industry. You know, we're working with some really good sports in Norway, so a really good endurance physiologist there. That's helping us review and reflect around how we train. Our connection into the outside world is critical for us to really review and reflect about where we're at. So it's a whole perspective view about performance. And my role as performance director is to work really closely with our coaches, with our sport directors, with our performance support, and with our riders to give them the best opportunity to succeed. We want them to be the best, and so we have to be the best to enable that to happen. So we've started that process, and there's just great connection and a great desire to do it from everybody. In some ways, it makes my role easy because of that desire from people to say we want to get back to the top and we want to sustain it for a period of years. But it's not just about what we do next year. It's about planning for 2030 and beyond. And it's that mentality that's really refreshing to come into. Like, you can't not look at other teams and other individuals, but equally got to have confidence in what you do and your own processes. And often, actually, the best stuff's not happening in your own sport. And I think that's the thing that we're trying to reconnect with. Some of the best endurance scientists are up in Scandinavia. So really connecting with that space. They're in America. They're in other areas, and bringing people in who don't know anything about our sport and asking the challenging questions about how we approach things is the type of environment that we're creating again, and that will move us forward.
I tried desperately to pin down John Allett a few weeks ago and get him to sort of nail your colours to the mast and say explicitly our goal is to win the Tour de France again in 2024-2025 with a British rider, for example.
Yeah.
Are you willing to make that kind of explicit sort of statement of intent?
Well, I think I've already said to you that we want to win the Grand Tours. Our focus down to becoming a Grand Tour team, and the biggest Grand Tour of them is the Tour de France, who was without a doubt. But the other Grand Tours play a particular role in developing riders to then go and do that. So yeah, we are going for that. I can't give you a date because the reality is we will take care of our processes. And it's really hard to say in that element of it, but certainly in the next few years, we want to be competing at that highest level and be seen to be going in as a favourite. We are the hunters in some ways at the moment. We used to be the hunted. That's the language that sort of we're articulating, and that makes you hungry to want to succeed. So I have no doubt that we're on the right path. We've no doubt got things to change. We got no doubt ways that we need to review and reflect on ourselves, but we are going to look to win the Tour de France. I just can't give you a date when that's going to happen.
Last night, Tymon Arensman's father tweeted about the fact that he was at the Giro d'Italia, so he was away from a coach that was going to meddle with his preparation and ruin things for him.
But it's really hard if you're outside to the context of what's going on. We know Grand Tours are 3-week races. We know Tymon is always exceptionally strong across those 3 weeks, and especially strong in that third week. So you can't just take a single view on one stage. Like, the reality is every rider's probably going to have a bad moment within this stage, especially as a GC contender. So we'll continue to support him, back him. We know he's a super talented individual, and I have no doubt that people are going to see some real strengths in time and throughout this race, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Any minute now, Rose Manley and the Cycling Podcast Feminin team will be back. They'll be recapping the Vuelta Femenina, the Spanish stage race, which has just concluded, and they will be covering the whole week of racing from Spain in an episode of Arrivé. So look out for that on the Cycling Podcast feed. It will be out, in the next day or so. You may remember last year we made an episode of Kilometre Zero at the Tour de France called Enter the Slipstream. It was about a brilliant film made during the lockdown edition of the Tour de France in 2020, going behind the scenes with the EF Education First team. The film came out last year in the US, and it is about to have its UK theatrical premiere in London on May the 16th at the Via Atelier Bike Shop. That is in Stable Street, London. There are also screenings in Manchester, Alderley Edge to be precise, at Velo Edge Bike Shop. That's on May the 18th. And in Scotland, in Glasgow, at the Drygate Brewery on May the 19th. And you can get tickets for all of those events. And if you look out for the 11:01 cappuccino tomorrow, there'll be links to buy tickets and give yourself a chance to watch the film. It really is worth a watch. And I'll post the audio to our episode in tomorrow's edition of the 11:01 cappuccino, so you can hear a bit about the making of the film Enter the Slipstream. It featured our very own Richard Moore and Francois Thomazeau as expert Tour de France talking heads as well. So that's Enter the Slipstream, UK theatrical premiere in London on May the 16th at Via Atelier Bike Shop, and subsequent screenings in Alderley Edge and Glasgow. But as I say, check out the 11:01 cappuccino tomorrow, Monday, for more details. Back to Daniel and Brian and their summary of stage two.
Well, Brian, park here?
Yes.
Window up.
It looks a pretty safe neighbourhood, but we'll put the windows up anyway. Brian, yesterday in the morning, I did a little pilgrimage up to Superga. Today, a different kind of pilgrimage. Promised the listeners, promised ourselves a couple of weeks ago that while we were in Turin, we would take advantage of that to go and, well, pay a visit to someone who's very dear to the Cycling Podcast listeners, dear to particularly those who listen to our Giro d'Italia coverage. He's been a feature of our Giro d'Italia coverage for many years. The team manager of what was formerly known as Salitalia, Sidermec, lots of different iterations, hasn't it, this team?
Venezuela.
Venezuela. In many ways, well, he's referred to often as the Prince of Turin, il Principe. Gianni Savio, of course, we're talking about. Gianni has not had a good 2 or 3 months. He's had a crash running, broken some bones, and he's holed up at home, Castello Savio. I've never been to, in all the years I've known Gianni, and I've known him for about 20 years now, and had, well, endless conversations with Gianni in that period, but I've never been to his house, so we're going to go and see how he's doing and pass on the best wishes of the Cycling Podcast listeners most of all. Brian, I'm slightly ashamed that we haven't got him a gift. We talked about bringing him a gift. I don't know if I've got anything we can rummage around in the back of the... I've got a Sornier Duval jersey in my rucksack.
I have a Cuban cigar in my briefcase. But he's...
You can ask him.
You know, an avid runner as yourself, and I think listeners of the Cycling Podcast have probably seen even little snippets of him running on the finish line. And he's actually the only one of the few gentlemen of the world who can run in a suit
and look
in
good
a stylish
it,
way.
And look good doing
That's
it.
That's a feat.
Anyway, I'm sure our presence alone will be enough of a gift. It wouldn't be for me, but it might be for him, for Gianni. So
I think he deserves also, it's an honourable mention, and imagine him being stuck whilst the Giro, the Grande Partenza, is in his hometown.
Exactly. Savio Briano.
Sì?
Pronto, sono Daniel, sono qua per Gianni.
Ah, sì.
Grazie. Ancora no.
To crash,
fractures,
broken,
hmm?
broken
vertebra, vertebra broken. Mm. Okay.
Gianni, it's an honor to be here in your house. Gianni, I was just telling the listeners, I've known you for many, many years now, and I've never been here before. So, thank you for hosting us this morning for a brief visit. But Gianni, we wanted to come here to wish you the very best from the listeners, because everyone's missing you at this Giro d'Italia, and we know you've been having a tough time recently. Tell us what happened 3 or 4 months ago.
I was running, I had a break.
Crashed, you fell?
Sì, caduta. And I have two vertebrae broken, and one costola, not broken, but with one incrinatura, I don't
crack.
I am in a position, unfortunately, that I must stay in my house. The doctor told me not go. You must be in your house because, and I think that is right. Io qui cammino, no?
Ma you can walk in your house.
Here I am able to walk, but with many attention.
Well, Gianni, the most important thing is that you get yourself well again, and we want to see. We don't care about Pogacar. We want to see you in your top condition soon. But thank you for inviting us into your home, and once again, Gianni, you have everyone's thoughts and best wishes.
Thanks. I am very happy to tell with many, many, many tifosi, the suiveur, the fans.
Brian, that was this morning, and that was an important... Well, I talked yesterday about the pilgrimage to Superga, and it was important for us to
to go and see Gianni. Give him our best wishes, the listeners' best wishes. He is really suffering at the moment, isn't he? He's suffering because the Giro d'Italia literally went past his window yesterday. And Gianni is such a fixture, he's such a larger-than-life character at the Giro d'Italia. You know, you'll have heard us say before, and you'll have heard other journalists talk about Gianni, how he used to do the rounds of the press room. He's the only team manager who has ever really done that. It was a daily fixture.
Came to see you last year.
Yeah, it was a daily fixture for us and everyone else. That sort of an hour after the finish every day, Gianni would come in. He would greet everyone, go along the line, shaking everyone's hand, giving them any information they needed.
I think he would do it even if he didn't have a team in the race.
Yes, he would. And people might be wondering, did we ask Gianni what would have been the modulo? Gianni, famously on the cycling podcast, he used to give us his formation. As we know, Gianni, well, he's a big football fan, and we talk about formations in football, but Gianni used to talk about them in cycling. We did ask him for his formation today, a 4-3-1, I think it was.
4-3-1. Four are the riders that must attack, because we won. I think that
we promised as well that we would maybe check in with Gianni later in the Giro. He'll be watching. He'll be watching every stage, predicting a Pogacar victory, which is not surprising. Oh, Brian, before we forget, before we move on too quickly to talk about tomorrow's stage, we had a conversation in the car about the Pantani loving. And the crowds were fantastic today, and we were delighted to see such fantastic crowds. I hadn't seen such big crowds on a Giro mountain stage for years and years. An awful lot of them in Pantani regalia, Pantani Mercatone Uno kits, bandanas. We talked earlier about the Curva Pantani, the Pantani corner 2.6 kilometers ago. I think today in the car, maybe last night as well, we talked about how jarring this can all be. We talk a lot, we wax poetic a lot about Pantani's exploits. Sometimes we're very conflicted about it, and we say that we're conflicted about it, but this one in particular causes me issues because of its proximity. It was literally, I don't have it in front of me, but it was less than a week before Madonna di Campiglio, when he was kicked out of the Giro d'Italia for failing a blood test, indicating, which was a strong indicator, that he was taking EPO.
You know, in other eras, in other countries, that you talk about truth and reconciliation, and I think there's the movement here is more reconciliation than it is truth. And, you know, I think it's perfectly understandable that you idolize certain riders in the same way that you would idolize a rock star. You know, you have the famous Club 27, you know, of big names burning their candle in both ends. But I think the vibe amongst the fans, I think I'll leave that to the fans, and they each have their own sense of what happened and how they feel about it. But I also think when you, as a journalist, you can't just pretend that that didn't happen. As you mentioned, this, I believe it was the 30th of May in 99 on the stage of Europa, and then shortly after, you know, the disgraceful exit at the Madonna di Campiglio. I would even say after that, I mean, in spite of an era being completely marred by doping and everything that we found out later on, but it's also the fact that Pantani died as a lonely drug addict, and there's other parts of that I think we tend to sort of cross over and I think there's a lot. I mean, there's certainly reasons to celebrate Pantani and his exploits and everything. But I think that there's another side of the coin, another side of that story that needs to be told. I mean, I was talking to a school teacher here just before who had a group. They won a competition that RCS had initiated, and they had a group of grade three kids up here. They're still kids when they're in grade three. And they, you know, just as they left now where we are sitting, they were talking about Pantani, and, you know, they hadn't seen a bike race before, and they couldn't be here without seeing all this Pantani fanfare. And they, you know, saw Pogacar, and the teacher herself had been here on that day when Pantani won here. And so for her, I think it must also be a little bit, if they asked her who was Pantani, I mean, I'd be quite curious to see what the answer was. I mean, for it's a child at that age, you can't say, well, he died tragically and he, you know, he was later expelled from the Giro. But us grown-ups and people who follow the sport, I think we need to keep that in mind.
Sometimes it feels as though all it needs is an asterisk or a qualifier that, you know, I mentioned earlier, a journalist that we admire and we've talked about before on the podcast, Marco Pastonesi. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but I read something from him writing the present day, or talking the present day, a few days ago, about this being one of the great page, or the ultimate sort of exploit, the ultimate page in cycling history, the most beautiful ever written. And it was a week before the guy failed what was essentially a dope test. So the question becomes, what qualifier do you give in that situation? Well, you talk about the moment. The moment was intoxicating for a lot of people. As I said in our preview, it wasn't for me. The spectacle was fantastic, but I think, you know, particularly we as journalists, we're supposed to be, to a certain extent, linguists as well, and I just think you have to choose your words carefully and considerately.
If you describe your memory of that day isolated, I think you can do that. It's almost like a question of how you would evaluate literature, but I think it becomes fiction when you don't finish the story with everything else that happened. Yeah. I'm certainly not able to look at certain eras in cycling without, you know, thinking about what we know now. And I think for the fans, I'll leave that to them. I think that's, you know, we all have different memories that way, but I think even as much as I would say I'm certainly also a fan of the sport of cycling, but here I'm a journalist also, and I'm someone who's supposed to have or try to have an objective opinion about the present and the past, so it's hard for me to just not have that asterisk that you mentioned.
Let's talk not about today, but let's talk about tomorrow.
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, risotto last night, and we'll be riding. We won't be riding, fortunately, and we'll be driving over the paddy fields tomorrow morning because we're starting in risotto country. Last night's risotto was a beetroot risotto. You had it, I had it. It was excellent. That's two risotti in two evenings for me. I don't know if I'm going for the risotto hat trick tonight, but hopefully there'll be one on offer. But Brian, is that enough about yesterday's day? Oh, we also had the Barbera wine, which was too alcoholic, which was 16%. Shocking number.
Yeah, for the first time in a long time, I didn't really finish the glass.
It's like an Angelo Zomignan sort of climb, isn't it? There's a point at which it just gets a bit silly.
Yeah, it's like doing the Mortirolo twice. And
of course, we didn't realize this until we ordered it. And Brian, tomorrow's stage, please.
Yes, so tomorrow's stage is from Novara to Fossano. 166 kilometers. There's only one categorized climb, and it's a category 4, and it's already after 58 kilometers of racing. So by and large, the first sprinter stage, unless you want to count your blessings to see a breakaway go, but I think this, we're looking at, is it kind of runs parallel. We go past Torino, we sort of go parallel from north to south. And it finishes in Fossano. And this could have been the wine stage, really, because we pass certain wine areas. You know, we also pass Cinzano.
Which is quite after 135
famous
kilometers.
For anyone who's had an aperitivo in this part of the world. But we also pass Alba. There'll definitely be some vineyards. And that's probably the most important or most interesting thing at this point I can say about the stage, because I mean, it's relatively short still in Giro terms compared to last year, so I think we're looking at a sprinter stage. We shall see.
Fossano, home of Balocco. We talked about them in relation to Chiara Ferragni in the Pandoro Gate. God, look that up. And you know, if you're not familiar with the story, try to.
I think there'll be a movie made of that eventually.
Try to fight your way through that labyrinth. A couple of other things, Brian. Not in relation to tomorrow's day. You mentioned Cinzano. Of course, famous aperitivo. Today we're in Biella. There's a link, actually. There is a link, and it reminds me. Fossano, so home of Balocco, who make the Pandoros. Balocco were also sponsor of the pink jersey.
I remember that.
For a few years. The pink jersey that Pantani was wearing at Europa in 1999 was made by Fila. And Fila are from Biella, at the bottom of the mountain here. Fila, of course, of Bjorn Borg fame.
And Boris Becker.
At the start of his career, he did. I'd love to get my hands on one of those Fila.
Didn't he?
Pantani
Becker went on to Sergio Tacchini after, didn't
he? I think so. But a very sort of long-standing Biella institution is Fila. At the bottom of the climb today, I also noticed a stadium dedicated to, or named after, Vittorio Pozzo, who was the coach of Torino just before they became the Grande Torino. And John Foote talked about him in our Grande Torino special. he was the gentleman who unfortunately had to identify the bodies at Superga. He'd also been the Italian national coach and won the World Cup twice, and he had to identify the bodies of players that he knew very well at Superga in 1949. Brian, we're going to play out tonight with another sort of somber note. A couple of days ago, or was the 3rd of May, a luminary of Italian cycling unfortunately passed away, Imerio Massignan. A rider that not that many people will be very familiar with, I would suggest, but you certainly would have been familiar with him if you were a fan of the Giro d'Italia in the late 50s, the very end of the 50s, and the 60s. Someone who does know an awful lot about Imerio Massignan and that era is our friend Herbie Sykes, author of lots of books about cycling, also a resident of Turin. Herbie was at the start, he rode to the start this morning. And I met him.
Was he on a Geos bike?
He was on a Geos bike.
Famous Torino frame builder.
He was. So we're going to play out tonight with Herbie's little tribute to Imerio Massignan. Brian, we're off down the mountain in Darwin Atapuma. I fear that this might be Darwin Atapuma's last day on the Giro d'Italia.
I hope so.
And hopefully we'll be having a lovely dinner. But that's all for tonight. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Extraordinary who you bump into at the start in the Canavese, which is an area that's not, well, it's not the kind of area where you would expect to bump into luminaries of cycling authorship. However, Herbie Sykes, a voice that's familiar to listeners of the Cycling Podcast. Herbie, you're quite attached to this region, you live in Turin. But the reason we have summoned you today is that, well, Italian cycling has kind of been mourning, has been for the last 48 hours or so, because on the eve of this year's Giro d'Italia, a luminary of an era that you are certainly very interested in and have written extensively about passed away. Who was it, and tell us why we should be paying our respects this weekend to this rider?
Imerio Massignan passed away yesterday. Imerio's a very interesting character and one of the most loved Italian cyclists from the early 60s. He turned professional a few weeks before the 1959 Giro d'Italia. Tullio Campagnolo called Eberardo Pavesi, who was the sports director of Legnano. He's from Vicenza, which is Campagnolo country. Tullio Campagnolo called the DS of Legnano, Pavesi, and said, "Look, I've seen this guy. He's fantastic. He climbs like something phenomenal." And they pitched him into the Giro. And it was an unusual Giro. In fact, it was a unique Giro because it was the first Giro in which Italy had no GC rider. They'd become accustomed to losing the Giro. Gaul had won the Giro. Coblet had won the Giro. But they went into the Giro with no GC rider. Nencini and Baldini, the previous two winners, were, for all sorts of reasons, didn't figure. They hadn't raced. So Imerio became the story of that Giro, and he rode beautifully well, incredibly well, finished I think fifth or sixth on GC, and in the penultimate stage, which was a 300 kilometre stage to Courmayeur, where Gull ultimately won the Giro, he produced a sensational ride. He came second behind Charlie Gull, and he was infantile in a really beautiful way. He was completely guileless, devoid of cynicism. He just rode himself into oblivion, and the Italian public fell in love with the guy. And you couldn't not fall in love with Imerio. He was that kind of person. He was a cyclist all the other cyclists wanted to win, and that's very unusual. And thereafter, for the next 3-4 years, really, he just continued to lose bike races. And, of course, each time that he lost, so the love grew.
Italian Pulidor, in a way.
He wasn't as good as Pulidor, but he was, it was that thing where he became a bit of a course celeb. In 1960, Torriani introduced the Gavia to the Giro d'Italia for the first time, and he made the stage on the Gavia. He was leading, he was destined to win it, and he punctured. Gavia was a mule track, and he punctured at least twice on the descent, maybe three times, some say four times in the way of these things, and Gaul nipped around him in the closing metres and won the stage. Imerio famously broke down in tears, and that image became very kind of symbolic of the redolent of that time. Following year, Torriani introduced the Moro di Sormano in Giro di Lombardia. Only three or four guys rode up it. He rode up it first because he was, as I say, as a climber, he was sensational. Vita Tacone, who was his polar opposite, really. He was
abrasive.
Yeah, very abrasive. He caught him on the run into Como. and beat him in the sprint. So it was another Imerio moment, and these things kept happening to him. He lost the 1962 Giro to Balmamion because the team was a shambles. But the Italian public loved this guy. I mean, really loved this guy.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burnett.